Welcome, Archive members. This episode takes us to Puerto Rico. It's a location known for its dense rainforest, strategic and mysterious military presence, and one of the highest concentrations of reported unidentified aerial phenomena in the world. Tonight we will discuss reported alien sightings, some cryptids, and the restricted military zones. And this is all coming off of the International Month. So, welcome in to the Ominous Archives. Welcome, Archive members. As you all know, I am Nick.
And I'm Em.
And before we get into this episode, I have some stuff to tell you, Em, about Saturday night and a Sunday morning.
Okay.
It was all quiet. Nothing was stirring.
I don't like this.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
So it was wild. We're all sleeping, and my back was killing me. So I don't know. I just heard the myth that, you know, staying on the floor, mm-hmm. like a hard surface, is like supposed to help. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'll stay on the floor, which is fine because Kobe will then come and lay with me.
Right.
So, and it's everything was quiet. It was all good. And we sleep with our door open because Kobe will like to wake us up in the middle of the night because he would like to go downstairs and not stay in the room the whole night. And so, and it's vice versa. If he wants to come into the room, he'll just sit there and bark. Mm. And we don't want to wake the baby, so we just leave the door open. Well, we're all sleeping, like I said, for the fourth time. And it's 3:30 in the morning. And Kobe stands up and lets out this deep, like, don't even think about it, growl and bark.
Nope.
Like his big boy bark.
Yeah, his big boy bark.
Not the playing around.
Right.
I just knocked the mic with my hat. But not that like playing around, like lighthearted
bark.
Yeah,
no,
like,
he was serious.
This was like a what are you doing kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Frank and I woke up and we were like, what was that? And she's like, go check downstairs. And I was like, all right, cool. I ran downstairs, but instinctively, I was like, I'm not going to turn lights on because I know my house better than somebody if they're in here.
Right.
So I turned my head to like the way our steps are. You can stand like halfway up the steps and just kind of like peek your head around the corner. And that's what I did. But I didn't see anybody. So I was like, all right. Okay. So I went all the way downstairs and like the basement door was shut and the back door was locked up. We have a camera on the back deck that has a motion sensor light. That was off. For kicks, I just turned on the back porch light anyway.
Right.
Didn't see anything. Checked the front door. That was locked. Looked like kind of in our driveway. Didn't see anything.
Right.
Like, this is wild. So I go back upstairs and Frank's like, did you see anything? And I'm like, no, I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. She's like, all right. And she's like, well, he's kind of just like laid back down. I'm like, okay. So I lay back down. Now he puts his head down. He's calm and collected. And we all start falling back asleep. Out of nowhere, his head just shoots up.
No.
He stares down our hallway and is just growling. And I'm like, what is going on? So now I get up and I check the back half of the house upstairs. So I mean, our bathroom, I could see everything in the bathroom.
Right.
But I was like, I'll just go in here and check.
Check Did the shower that. Curtain. Like.
Yeah. Well, the curtain was open. So if anything, it was like, check the window. I could see the window. So I did that. Then I went into the like gym office area, turned that light on, nothing. Opened my blinds because we have a deck roof and nothing. So I'm like, this is wild. It's 3:30 in the morning and he never does this. Like, he does not let the big boy bark out.
Right. Like, he's serious.
And I laid back down, and at that point, things, like, I didn't hear nothing, didn't see nothing go weird or whatever. We sent goofball Archie out, and Archie's just, like, like, looking all around. And I'm like, well, either he's, like, he's got a problem with his spirit sight or something, or Kobe was hearing something from somewhere else.
Right.
But it was like two or three more times where I laid down, and like, again, he's next to me because I'm laying on the floor, and I'm like kind of drifting off, but now I'm kind of like on alert.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually Frank falls back asleep, and now it's just me and Kobe sitting there, and I'm like closing my eyes and stuff, but my like, he's like laying against my leg, and I can feel him. And like two or three more times at night, his head's down, and he would just shoot his head up and just stare out in our hallway.
Okay, so clearly we need to have somebody come in and do like something. See if we've got like ghosts or something.
I don't know. It's.
Do you ever feel like creeped out, like ever in here?
I think I get more creeped out because I kind of am like, well, it's dark, and if somebody's in my house, you know, it's the, if somebody comes in your house during the day, they want items.
Yeah.
Somebody comes in at nighttime.
Yeah.
There's a problem.
Right.
So it's kind of like, the ghost thing doesn't bother me too much.
Right. But I feel like if it wasn't a ghost, Kobe's crazy. Kobe would take somebody out. Like, for you guys, I feel like Kobe would be all over that if it wasn't a ghost.
Oh, I think he totally would.
Which leads me to believe him just acting like that makes me think supernatural.
Yeah.
That's and wild.
Yeah. To kind of, like, add, like, the little other thing. He's like, now, too, I feel like all the other podcasts I listen to, I've been doing a lot of audiobooks lately, so I've been out of touch with my other podcasts that I listen to. And I mean, they're all much bigger than us, so they don't need these shout outs. But so I do Morbid and the Two Girls, One Ghost. And I feel like now they both have ghosts. Well, Two Girls, One Ghost has always had a ghost. But now I feel like Morbid's got one. They got that little like spirit box that talks to them all the time. And I'm like, not that we've talked to them, like, ever or anything like that, but I'm like, is this just, like, a podcast thing? Do you get a pod? Do you start, like, podcasting about cryptids and haunted things, and next thing you know, you're just haunted?
Next thing you know, you have a ghost.
You open a door or something.
Yeah, that's wild, though.
It's insane.
I like that you waited to tell me that until we recorded,
I waited all week. All week.
He's been sitting on that one for a week. I would just like everybody to know.
We always come on here, and we're always like, oh, you got anything new?
Nothing new.
Because we like, talk during the week.
We talk during the week. It's like we've got nothing to catch up on.
Yeah.
Well, that was wild.
Yeah.
And now I'm kind of like unsettled sitting in the archives right now.
Well, we got our little Mothman. My mom has a 3D printer.
Yes.
And all you audio people, you can't hear it or see it. But she found out how to make little cryptids. He's a little guy.
I like him. Only He's very inches. Cute. I want a mini Pukwudgie next.
Oh, I was looking. I couldn't find one. But anyway, let's get into this episode. I've talked your ear off for long enough.
Let's.
But before we do get into that strange stuff from Puerto Rico, I want to give you some geographic and historical context because I think it actually makes everything that comes after this hit kind of harder.
All right. Set the scene for me.
So, Puerto Rico. It sits in the northeastern Caribbean. It's right between the Atlantic Ocean and the Caribbean Sea. And because of where it sits, right along major maritime and air routes historically tied to trade and defense and access to the Panama Canal, it has been strategically important to the United States military over a century.
So this isn't just a beautiful island, it's a beautiful island that the military very much wanted a part of.
Yeah, exactly. And starting in the early 20th century, especially leading into World War II, the US began building a significant network of military infrastructure across the island. We have naval bases, there's airfields, radar systems, training ranges, the whole nine.
A lot of infrastructure for one island.
It's a lot. And the most significant piece of that infrastructure, at least for our purposes today, is a facility called the Roosevelt Roads Naval Station.
All right. Well, tell me about this Roosevelt Roads.
Roosevelt Roads was located in Caleb on Puerto Rico's eastern coast, established in 1943, and at its peak, it was one of the largest U.S. naval facilities in the entire world.
One of the largest in the entire world on an island.
Yeah, on an island.
Okay.
It had a major airfield capable of supporting large military aircraft, deep water port facilities. I'm assuming, I thought submarine. I'm sure it could, but deep water, I just went submarine. There was housing for thousands of personnel and their families, extensive logistic infrastructure. It was essentially a small city opened as a military base.
Okay, so strategically, what was its actual purpose?
Its primary role was securing Caribbean sea lanes and protecting access to the Panama Canal through World War II and then all the way through the Cold War. It was a long-term strategic anchor for the entire region.
And I'm going to go with, since we're talking about it on this lovely podcast of ours, it probably has some less official documented functions.
Yeah. well, here's where it's going to start getting interesting. Because of its location, right next to the El Yucan. And I said it wrong. It's Yucan. El Yucan. Which we will absolutely be talking about in detail. Roosevelt Roads sat in the middle of a region that became associated with a really unusual volume of reported unidentified aerial phenomena. Throughout the late 20th century, sightings were reported by civilians in the area and by military personnel operating from the base itself.
So the people running the radar are also seeing things that they can't explain.
Some of them. The reports, they remain unverified, and I want to be clear about that. But they are part of a much broader pattern that we are going to dig into. Now, Roosevelt Roads was closed in 2004.
Why?
That's going to connect to something we're going to talk about in a moment. And it is one of the heavier parts of today's episode. But here's the thing that Sam really pointed out when she was, you know, researching the topic. The base got reactivated in September of 2025.
Oh, like recently.
Really recently.
Yeah.
As of right now, it is functioning again as a military operations hub. There are reports of F-35 fighters operating out of it. The official reason given is regional instability and the need for strategic positioning in the Southern Caribbean.
So a base that was closed for 20 years just came back online.
Came back online like rebooting a computer. or I guess came back online like Jurassic Park. Depends on how you look at it. which it's, given everything else we're going to talk about today, feel like a detail worth stating.
Yeah, I'm sitting with it. I don't love it, but I'll sit with it.
It's a good thing because you are sitting in a chair. why did it close in the first place? That brings us to the part of today's story that I want to make sure we're going to handle carefully because it matters.
All right. I'm sad.
So Vieques is a small island municipality off the eastern coast of Puerto Rico. And from the 1940s until May 1st, 2003, so roughly six decades, the eastern portion of the island was used by the U.S. Navy as a primary bombing range and training area.
Six decades.
And when I say bombing range, I want to be specific about what that actually means in practice. Mm. because over that time period, the Navy conducted extensive live fire exercises on the island. More than 300,000 rounds of ammunition were used, conventional explosions, and in at least one confirmed instance, depleted uranium.
Depleted uranium on a highly populated island.
In 1999, the Navy acknowledged firing 263 rounds containing depleted uranium into what they called a live impact area. That acknowledgement came after the fact, after the rounds were already fired.
So the people that were living there just had no idea?
Nope, not at the time.
Cool.
And the environmental impact of 60 years of this kind of activity is significant is almost too small of a word. Documented issues include soil and groundwater contamination from heavy metals, mercury, lead, copper, residual explosive compounds throughout the land from decades of munitions use, and a very large quantity of unexploded ordnance that is still there.
Still as in, like, right now?
As in right now. The site was designed a Superfund cleanup location by the Environmental Project Agency, and cleanup efforts are ongoing and are projected to extend into at least the early 2030s. Because of the scale of contamination and the number of unexploded bombs remaining, is that significant?
I don't even know what to say about that. The fact that I haven't heard, like, this is the first I'm hearing about it is crazy. People live there.
People do live there. And residents of Viakis have reported elevated rates of cancer and other serious illnesses. Some studies have suggested possible environmental factors. The U.S. government's own research has not established a definitive causal link. That's the official position. But the pattern is there, and the community has been living with it.
And what ended it? Like, what finally stopped the Navy from using it?
Protests. So, widespread, sustained protests. And they intensified after a specific moment in 1999. A civil security guard named David Sains was killed during a training exercise. He was in the wrong place, a stray bomb, and his death, a central catalyst for the movement demanding the Navy's withdrawal.
Someone just died during a routine training exercise on just a normal island where people are supposed to be living.
Yes. And that loss is what turned sustained frustration into a movement that ultimately could not be ignored. Military operations on Viakis ended in 2003. Following the Navy's departure, most of the land was transferred to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and designated as a National Wildlife Refuge. Although certain areas remain closed to the public due to safety hazards, the unexploded ordnance.
So it's a wildlife refuge that you can't even fully enter because there's active live bombs in it.
That's a pretty accurate description of the current situation.
Okay, I just want to say, before we move on, that is a real community, real people, and I think it's important that we said all of that clearly rather than just treating it as a footnote to the more dramatic parts of this story, because that is absolutely wild.
Absolutely. And I think the reason it matters for everything that follows is that it establishes something real about this region. There is documented, verified government acknowledged activity in Puerto Rico that is genuinely difficult to process, which means that when we start talking about the things that aren't officially verified, the radar contacts, the sightings, the encounters, we're not starting from zero. We have started from a place where unusual and troubling things have already been confirmed to have happened here.
Yeah, the context definitely matters.
It always matters. And with that, now let's talk about the things in the sky. So, some researchers and investigative groups have described Puerto Rico as a high-frequency reporting area for unidentified aerial phenomena. And that classification isn't based on one or two stories. It's based on the volume and consistency of sightings reported over several decades, particularly from the 1960s through the early 2000s.
And who's doing this reporting? Because I feel like that matters a lot.
It does. And this is the part of what makes Puerto Rico stand out. Because the reports aren't coming just from one type of source. You have civilian eyewitnesses, you have military personnel, you have radar operators, and you have pilots.
Pilots and radar operators are not people I feel like are typically easily spooked by lights in the sky. That's kind of their whole job, is knowing what's in the sky.
Yeah, pretty much, you'd think. And they have all kinds of... I was going to say, they have all kinds of radars. And the island's geography makes it a genuinely unusual environment for this kind of reporting. The mountainous terrain, dense rainforest, ocean on all sides, long-term military activity creating overlapping conditions where both conventional and unexplained aerial activity are being observed simultaneously. It's a complicated airspace even before you add anything strange to it.
All right, so even figuring out what's normal up there, I feel like, is difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely really hard, which makes the cases that do stand out for a reason. And I want to take you to one specific case that I think is genuinely one of the more remarkably documented encounters in the broader history of UAP reporting. Not just in Puerto Rico, but in general.
You have my full undivided attention.
I should have had it since the start.
Hey, you have. I'm just really locked in here.
Yeah, you're about as
I
locked.
I am, actually.
You seem as locked in as Archie right now.
Well, Archie is sleeping. I'm actually locked in. I need to know now.
So, in November of 1964, there is a U.S. Navy destroyer operating in the waters north of Puerto Rico, the USS Guyot.
The USS Guyot.
And over the course of several nights, November 16, 17, 18, 19, and the 24th.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. The radar operators and crew aboard the ship make repeated contact with an unidentified object. Side note, why do all wild and crazy things, paranormal, alien, why does it always happen in November?
Yeah.
That's like the one thing, like, we did a research project. My birthday's in November.
Yeah.
I did a research project, and I was like, you know, there's some, like, famous people and stuff, but November was a pretty boring month besides Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Now I'm realizing it's because that's when all the paranormal stuff takes place. And when...
You just haven't been looking in the right spot.
What is it? Conformity Gate is going to be dropped again. It's going to drop on my birthday.
Right, right.
I said that as soon as it ended, and everybody was like, complaining about it. I was like, I looked at Frank and I was like, I guarantee you something will drop on November 6th this year because it all started on that month.
It did. You were here, folks, first.
The series didn't start, but the whole... So why would it not end on that date?
I see what you're saying here.
You heard it here.
Anyway, back to this. So it repeated over multiple nights.
Yeah, multiple nights. Same area, and what they're tracking is not behaving like anything with a conventional explanation. The object appeared at both low and high altitudes. It traveled at widely varying speeds, from a slow movement all the way up to like supersonic velocity, and it demonstrated rapid acceleration and deceleration that should not be possible for any known aircraft of that era.
Okay, so definitely not a weather balloon.
Not a weather balloon.
Nor a blimp.
No, not a blimp. I just watching a show where a blimp crashed. There's another creepy thing we could talk about, the blimp in San Francisco. I'm really getting off topic this episode. but there's a blimp, I believe it was in San Francisco, that crashed, a military blimp that mm-hmm. crashed, and there were three people on it, and then by the time the military got there, the three people were gone.
Oh, poof. Great. Just,
poof. Mm-hmm. Vanished. Anyway, it was November 18th. The object was tracked at a low altitude as it passed over another vessel, the USS Bainbridge, at approximately 180 knots before disappearing from radar entirely.
So it just vanished?
Just vanished. And then it came back. And on November 19th, the decision was made to intercept it.
Hmm.
An F-8 Crusader, a supersonic jet fighter, was launched from Roosevelt Roads Naval Station, directed toward the target, and the pilot assigned to intercept it was Lieutenant Commander named Kyle H. Woodbury. Described in official communications as a experienced and reliable pilot.
Okay, so I need you to paint that picture for me. What exactly do they tell him? Like, he's going up to intercept. What exactly? They don't even know.
That's exactly it. He doesn't fully know. He has a radar contact. He has coordinates. He has a target. And he goes up. Conditions are clear. Strong visibility. Full moon. Yeah. You know. Good night to see whatever's up there. And he sees it.
Sees what?
He described it. He described the object as dark black or dark gray. It had a triangular or delta shaped form. He estimated its size at approximately 60 feet in length. No external lighting visible anywhere on it, except for a single bright emissions from the rear when it accelerated.
So it's a dark triangle with a glow to it when it moves in 1964.
Mm-hmm. And here is where it gets deeply strange.
As if it wasn't strange already.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't flee. It didn't just disappear. It maneuvered alongside the aircraft, keeping pace with him at a distance of several miles. Just
there. It was watching him, which is creepy and wild.
That's what it felt like to him. And when he engaged his afterburners, when he pushed the F-8 to close the gap, the object accelerated rapidly. It climbed above 50,000 feet and disappeared from view.
Just gone. Poof.
Poof. But the radar data collected during the encounter supported everything he described. The scope images showed sudden shifts in speed, moments where the object slowed significantly before accelerating again, a steep climb to higher altitude at an extreme velocity, and at one point, radar indicated the object was exceeding 1,700 miles per hour while climbing.
1,700 miles per hour?
While climbing.
That's... sure.
The physics of that are genuinely difficult to account for with 1964 technology, or honestly, with most technology since.
And this is all in official records.
Reported through military channels. Forwarded to Project Blue Book, which was the U.S. Air Force program responsible for investigating UAP at the time. And the object was officially categorized as an unidentified aircraft, which means it was recognized as a real tracked object, so they weren't dismissing it. They just couldn't identify what it was.
See, and somehow it's more unsettling than if they just said it wasn't real.
It's a lot more unsettling.
Yeah.
And the investigation that followed had some significant gaps. Initial conclusions were made before all the data had been fully reviewed. Radar photographs and detailed pilot reports arrive after preliminary assessment had already been filed. There's no record of interviews with all the radar personnel involved.
So they half-ass investigated it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And what additional communications from December... I almost said December 4th. I don't know where that came from. from December of 1964 confirmed was that no known U.S. aircraft or test flights were operating in that area at that time. Air Defense Commander ruled out high-speed experimental aircraft programs. Intelligence agencies could not match the object to any known foreign technology.
Okay, so it wasn't ours. It wasn't theirs. And it moved in ways that nothing they'd ever seen could move.
And then, one more detail I saved.
Great.
After Woodbury disengaged, after the object climbed away and disappeared,
mm-hmm.
it came back.
Great, perfect.
Behind his aircraft and trailed him briefly before disappearing again.
Did it follow him?
It followed him.
Ah.
And his official statement afterwards was that the object's performance exceeded any aircraft he had encountered or was aware of.
From an experienced combat pilot in an official report.
In an official report, that case was never resolved. No confirmed explanation. It just sits there in a record, unidentified.
You know, my cousin dragged me into this podcast and I was like, you know, sure, it's all going to be fun and we're going to talk about creepy little things. This is weird and I don't like it. This is a lot.
That's the job you signed up for, Em.
I absolutely did sign up for this. So what else happened in Puerto Rico? Because apparently we're still going.
Oh, we're just getting started. Oh. Because the skies aren't the only place things get strange down there. The land has its own stories. And the forest especially. So El Jugan National Forest, let me set that scene for you.
Please.
It is the only tropical rainforest in the entire U.S. National Forest System, rising up through the Luquillo Mountains in the northeast of the island. There's dense vegetation, constant rainfall, frequent fog, and visibility on a lot of the trail systems is genuinely limited, even in the daytime.
So it's beautiful, but also you can't really see what's in there with you.
That's the perfect description.
Great.
And beyond its ecological significance, which is real and remarkable, El Jugan has developed a reputation over decades as a location where reports of unusual activity are constantly recorded. And I mean constantly. Folkloric accounts, modern eyewitness reports, indigenous belief systems, it's layers on layers.
I love a location that layers.
And I want to start at the beginning because I think the foundation matters. Long before any modern UAP report or cryptid sighting, the rainforest was spiritually significant to the Tano people, the indigenous people of Puerto Rico.
Okay, tell me about that.
So in Tano cosmology, the mountains of El Jugan held deep spiritual importance. The mountain itself is associated with a deity called Yacayu, a central protective figure in the Tano belief. Considered a guardian of the island and natural forces, storms, winds, the kind of unpredictable weather the rainforest generates constantly, were interpreted as expressions of spiritual presence.
So the forest wasn't just a forest, it was alive in a specific, meaningful way.
In a very specific, meaningful way. And I think it's important context because when you have a location that has been understood as spiritually significant for centuries, that shapes how every subsequent strange experience gets interpreted. The forest has always been a place where something more than ordinary was expected.
That actually makes the later reports feel a little less random to me.
I think it makes them much less random.
Yeah.
And then alongside that indigenous framework, you have local folklore that developed over time. There are duendes.
Duendes?
Small supernatural beings. Oh, puckies. Trickster spirit. Common in Spanish-speaking cultures across Latin America, but with a specific character in Puerto Rico. In the context of El Yucan, they are described as inhabitants of the dense forest, capable of misleading travelers, causing disorientation, associated with unexplained sounds or movement in the undergrowth.
So if you get lost in the forest, the folklore already has an explanation for what happened to you.
The folklore has you covered. And there are two other local legends I want to mention briefly because they stuck with me. The first is called The Cave of the Crying Child, a story passed through oral tradition describing a child left in a cave whose cries can still be heard echoing through the forest.
That's terrible.
It's shared as a cautionary tale rather than a documented event, but imagine hiking through a fog-covered rainforest and hearing something that sounds like a child crying.
Yeah, I'd leave and not look back.
You may leave
might not
when
even
the
get
fog
there.
Sets. Yeah.
Right.
The plane would touch down and I'd be like, nope,
yeah,
nope, take back off.
Bad vibes.
And the other story is called La Francesa, a woman who returns after death to sing lullabies to her child. Tied to the areas just outside the forest, but part of a broader folklore of the northeastern Puerto Rico.
Okay, between the crying child and the ghost lullaby woman, the forest was already doing a lot before any UFOs showed up.
The forest was fully committed to being unsettled all on its own. And then the aerial phenomena started getting reported.
Well, because of course they did.
Since at least the 1950s, El Yucan has been associated with repeated sightings of unidentified aerial objects, and the descriptions are constant enough across different accounts to be worth taking seriously. Growing lights observe above the canopy or along rigid lines, objects move in silently, or at least speeds inconsistent with known aircraft. Sudden changes in direction or altitude, lights appearing and disappearing without any visible transition.
The no visible transition detail is the one that actually gets me the most, I feel, because a plane has a trajectory. It goes somewhere. These things just stop existing in one place and then just start existing somewhere else. That's just not real. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, you would think they'd... It has a point. It's going to go somewhere. Some of the reports described objects hovering over specific areas of the forest before ascending vertically. Others involve lights moving across the mountain peaks, partially obscured by fog. And not all of these have been explained. Some could be aircraft, atmospheric effects, light refraction in humid conditions, but not all of them.
Well, what about on the ground? Because you mentioned humanoid figures earlier, and I've been thinking about that since you said it, because you said it and then just moved along.
Right. So alongside the aerial reports, there is a smaller but persistent category of accounts involving humanoid figures within the forest itself. And the descriptions have reoccurring details across different accounts. Tall, thin figures moving quickly through dense vegetation, limited or no visible facial features, occasional descriptions of triangular or angular head shapes, silent movement typically observed at a distance.
No visible facial features.
Mm-mm. Slenderman style.
Okay, great, cool. That's not wild.
These are typically reported along less traveled trails, particularly during the early morning or evening hours when the fog is thickest and the visibility is lowest.
So the conditions where you're most likely to misidentify something are also the conditions where these things are most often seen.
Which is either a very reasonable explanation or extremely convenient timing, depending on your perspective. And there's one account from 1973 that gets referenced fairly often. A group ascending a trail reported encountering figures moving through the mist. One individual described being in close proximity to a figure that, and this is the detail that stays with me, did not register as warm or cold to the touch.
And what could you possibly mean by that?
It means whatever they reached toward, or whatever was near them, had no discernible temperature. No body heat. Not the coolness of the forest air. Just nothing.
I do have to say that's one of the strangest details I feel like we've... This is a weird one. I feel like this is one of the weirdest ones we've talked about on the pod.
Yeah, it made me excited. Like I said, yeah. I've been stoked since he's talked to me about it. No physical evidence. Unconfirmed account. But the detail is specific enough that it's hard to dismiss as pure imagination.
Yeah, I agree. What about, you mentioned 1992 earlier in your notes.
We did. In 1992, witnesses reported photographing two small humanoid figures near Mount Britton inside El Yukon. Described as short, thin-bodied, large head, dark eye regions.
Okay, so the classic gray alien description, I feel.
To a T. And those descriptions align with what gets reported globally in UAP-related encounters. The photographs have never been independently verified or scientifically authenticated, so it remains unconfirmed, but it's part of a pattern that is hard to ignore when you look at the full picture of what gets reported from this one forest.
Well, and then there's the chupacabra adjacent stuff.
There is. So El Yukon has its own localized variation of chupacabra type reports. Smaller or more agile creatures than the more widely known descriptions. Sightings occurring within dense vegetation rather than open farmland. Movement patterns suggesting climbing or arboreal behavior. And these actually predate the widespread chupacabra folklore, because the term chupacabra didn't really emerge until the 1990s, but reports from this region go back further.
So Puerto Rico potentially gave birth to the chupacabra legend.
Puerto Rico has a very strong claim to that, specifically from a cluster of reports out of the town called Moca in 1975, which predates the chupacabra name by about 20 years. Livestock deaths. Animals found with puncture wounds. Blood apparently absent from the bodies. Very little sign of struggle or typical predation.
So the vampire of Moca.
That's actually literally what they called it locally.
That's hilarious.
The vampire of Moca. And alongside those livestock incidents, residents were also reporting strange lights in the sky, objects moving silently at unusual speeds, and occasional sightings of unusual figures, some described as winged or humanoid. Later reports in 1977 described a winged figure with a small object or device on its back.
A device on its back?
Yeah, on its back. Which is a detail that does not fit neatly in any conventional cryptid framework.
No, it does not. I feel like I know my cryptids.
And then rounding out the regional picture, there is the 2013 Aguadilla footage. 3 minutes of thermal video taken by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. It shows an object navigating at low altitude around Rafael Hernandez Airport in Puerto Rico. Then dipping into the Atlantic Ocean without losing speed, and then apparently splitting into two.
You mean to tell me you went into the ocean and kept going?
Without slowing down.
Okay, cool.
And that brings us to something that researchers and local fishermen have been talking about for years. The Puerto Rico Trench, which runs north of the island. It's one of the deepest points on Earth, 5 miles deep in places. And the area south of Yaquis in particular is considered a hotspot for sightings by local fishermen and researchers.
How deep is the ocean and what is living in the ocean?
I believe it's the eternal question.
I actually don't want to know the answer.
I don't think anybody really wants... I mean, people want to know the answer, but I don't want to know the answer.
I mean, I'm serious, though. If something can go from air to ocean without slowing down, and the ocean is, what, 5 miles deep in places?
Some theories actually suggest an underwater base hidden in the deep trench near an area called Cabo Rojo. Fishermen have reported seeing glowing objects submerged in what they call the south depth zone.
So an underwater UFO base?
An underwater UFO base off the coast of Puerto Rico.
All right, like, I need a second.
Take your time. I've got all night.
I'm good. I'm fine. This is fine. It's just, it's a lot.
You're not. Em's never normally fine this deep into an episode.
I'm usually not fine, but let's keep going.
Okay, so Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico.
I want to take a second before we close out because I think this episode is a little different from some of what we cover on this show. And I want to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think that's right because it's not just one story. It's not one creature, one night, one event. There was a lot of layers here and it was decades of layers in history.
Yeah, I mean, you have documented military history. Verified government acknowledged activity, some of it genuinely troubling, like what happened on the Yaquis. You have radar tracked objects that trained pilots and operators couldn't identify. You have a rainforest that has been considered spiritually significant for centuries, and that continues to generate reports that don't have clean explanations. And you have communities, real people who've been living alongside all of this for generations.
And what strikes me is that Puerto Rico's reputation as a place of unexplained activity isn't built on one dramatic story that just got out of hand. It's built on consistency. The same kinds of things being reported by different kinds of people over a really, really long time period.
And that consistency doesn't prove anything. I want to be clear about that. What exists here isn't proof of extraterrestrial activity, but it is recorded. A long-layered, genuinely strange record of unexplained sightings and experiences and theories that continues to raise questions nobody's fully answered.
Some of those questions feel more urgent now that Roosevelt Roach just came back online, which is so crazy.
Yeah, that detail has been sitting with me since I first read it.
Yeah.
So if you are from Puerto Rico, or if you have spent time there, we would genuinely love to hear from you, your experiences, your stories, what you know that we don't, because this is the kind of topic where the people who actually live it always know more than the research does.
Always.
As always, this episode was researched and written by Sam from Scare Me Sam. And I want to say that genuinely and not just as a formality, because the depth and care in this research is what made this episode possible. With that, if you are in the mood for a creepy book recommendation, go out and check out her podcast because she definitely knows what she's doing.
Seriously, go follow her podcast at Scare Me Sam.
And follow the Ominous Archives on all of our social medias to stay up to date with anything we have new going on. Share the show with your friends, especially the ones who say they don't believe in any of this, because it may drive you guys to go to a place where this stuff happens. Legally. Don't trespass on places.
true.
That was one of those I had that.
Yeah, got it.
I had that error, and I was like, oh, it's probably a bad thing to say.
Well, the skeptics, always the best listeners once you finally get them to believe.
And as always, thank you all for being here. And stay weird and stay haunted.
Maybe don't go swimming off the coast of Cabo Rojo.
Yeah, I definitely probably would not at night. See ya.
See ya.